The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
How much alcohol do you drink each day? It's a direct question that should allow for a straightforward answer, but researchers have learned that not everyone is forthcoming with that information. And so they've turned to some other techniques of determining whether what people say about their alcohol use is, in fact, the truth. Joining us on this edition of UWM Today are Lisa Berger, scientist and associate professor in the Center for Applied and Behavioral Research at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM, and alongside her, Michael Fendrick, former Wisconsin Distinguished Professor at UWM and has now just recently moved on to take an associate dean position at the University of Connecticut, but still working very closely with Lisa on this and other projects. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
So Lisa, let's begin with you.
Sure.
First of all, why is it important that researchers or scientists understand how much alcohol we do drink?
Well, I think from looking at it from a clinical standpoint, it's important to know how much because it begins to allow practitioners and clients or patients to begin to establish targets as far as reducing alcohol use because there is a correlation between the amount of alcohol use that you drink, especially when it becomes heavier alcohol use, and then physical problems that can be experienced as well as social problems.
And so, Michael, from your standpoint, is it pretty common that folks across the spectrum don't always fess up and come be completely honest when asked questions about personal behavior like this?
Well, it really depends on the context. So in certain situations, it's completely normal and considered pretty typical to talk about heavy alcohol use. But particularly people who may find themselves in situations where they could be putting themselves at risk or others at risk. People who are, for example, if you're pregnant. People who maybe drink excessively and haven't reached the stage where they're aware that it's a problem and they may need treatment. They may not want to admit to themselves or to others in any context that they have a potential problem.
You know, it also occurs to me that sometimes people just may not really be paying that close mm-hmm. of attention to it. I remember being with an individual here in town, actually someone who is pretty well placed in the community, and I mm-hmm. was having a conversation, and they were saying to me that they had been at a briefing a few days earlier mm-hmm. When some experts were talking about warning signs of maybe drinking a little bit too much. Right. And he said to me, boy, they were saying, you know, 3-4 drinks at a setting could be a signal that you know, you may have some issues. And he said, boy, isn't that just a tailgate party at Miller Park? I mean, it never right. really dawned on him that, gee, that might be a little signal that regularly 3 or 4 or 5, in fact, could be too many.
Right. And I mean, in general, again, it's pretty contextual, but when we're talking about developing these biomarkers or testing these biomarkers, they potentially when you develop these biomarkers, they potentially have use in clinical settings beyond where the research has been developed, and that's the potential goal here is to have something that you could use in situations where people aren't likely to disclose or where you maybe need to monitor their behavior in ways that they may not be so conducive to being monitored in a self-report kind of situation.
Yeah, because there's always the fear, yeah. I suspect, that, gee, if I tell the truth to a researcher, is that going to show up somewhere? Will somebody other than this researcher who has promised me confidentiality, will somebody else be looking at this and say, what's going on here?
Well, that's actually an interesting question. Mm-hmm. And I've done a lot of research on biomarkers looking at other substances besides alcohol. And what always amazes me is that we find more – we always find more in the drug testing. You typically find more drug substance abuse in – or substance use in the drug testing than we do from what people tell us. And the issue is I think people are readily willing to say – you find out with a test, but I'm not necessarily going to tell you. So the research situation creates an interesting situation for people.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, Lisa, let's talk about this method that you and Michael and your other colleagues, and there are others around the country that you've been working with, developed to help people be kept honest when it comes to measuring, in fact, how much they drink. Michael mentioned biomarkers. For the benefit of our listeners, what is a biomarker and what specifically did you use in this research project that you folks were involved in?
Sure. First of all, alcohol biomarkers are ways in which to detect physiologically in the body if someone has been exposed to alcohol or consumed alcohol. And there are two categories of alcohol biomarkers. There are what are called indirect alcohol biomarkers as well as direct alcohol biomarkers. And indirect alcohol biomarkers are where, for example, a liver enzyme may be elevated because of alcohol use, or if it is elevated, it may be as a result of alcohol use. But it's indirect in the sense that that same liver enzyme could be elevated not because of alcohol use, but because of some other issue, such as a condition like obesity or diabetes. So those are the indirect alcohol biomarkers. And that represents some of the older or more traditional technology, which is still being used today. That's what indirect alcohol biomarkers are. The newer category of alcohol biomarkers are direct alcohol biomarkers, where – and they're analytes – as a result of the alcohol metabolism process, alcohol being broken down in the body, and these direct alcohol biomarkers, generally the only reason that they are in the body and elevated is because of alcohol use. So it's a more direct way of measuring alcohol exposure or alcohol consumption. So in the study that Michael and I were a part of conducting, we were asked by the United States Drug Testing Laboratories in Des Plaines, Illinois, if we would partner with them. In fact, Michael was approached by them to partner on a study to look at a direct alcohol biomarker, and then Michael invited me to join the research team. And this particular direct alcohol biomarker that was examined is called ethylglucuronide. And so what we did is we tested, along with United States Drug Testing Laboratories, ETG in both hair and fingernails to see how accurate the biomarker was in those two biological matrices in terms of detecting any alcohol use as well as risk levels of alcohol use.
And so what did you find?
What we found, our primary finding, was that in both hair and fingernails, in terms of ethylglucuronide, that both matrices do a good job of detecting any alcohol use. And we were interested in looking at ETG in hair and fingernails in terms of a long-term alcohol biomarker, so going back 12 weeks. And what we found at our three predetermined cut points is that both matrices, when ETG is detected, that it does a good job of detecting any alcohol use in the past 12 weeks.
Does it tell you how much alcohol has been used?
So with a biomarker like ETG, it's really more about detecting whether or not any alcohol use has been consumed or there's been some exposure to alcohol to make the biomarker elevated. So we're really primarily looking at, well, how well do hair and fingernails in terms of any ETG at these predetermined cut levels detecting alcohol? They're just detecting any alcohol use. What we did find in the secondary finding of our research was that fingernails look to be or may hold some promise in actually being able to detect risk levels of drinking.
So there would be some greater signal or sign in those nail clippings that someone is drinking more rather than less alcohol.
Fingernails do appear to be able to essentially better tell whether someone's been risk drinking or not in comparison to hair. You know, it's a very initial finding, and so definitely more research needs to be conducted as a result.
And one of the things you're looking for in biomarkers, one of the issues has been sensitivity, which is among those who are actually drinking, how well is the biomarker able to detect that? So when there's drinking, you know, what percentage of those who actually drink or drink at some level are detected by the biomarker? And then there's specificity for those people who aren't drinking. You know, what percentage of those non-drinkers are actually shown as not to be drinkers by those biomarkers? That's the specificity. This is a little bit of a technical term, but one of the issues is in looking at the, you know, the strength or the, what we also say the validity of a biomarker is, you know, how sensitive are they and how specific are they? And there may be some issues with some of the biomarkers that they're very sensitive, but not necessarily specific. And one of the issues that comes up, it's a tricky, thorny issue, and I was just reading about this morning, is that there are other ways that people can ingest alcohol that would potentially be detected by these biomarkers that is not drinking per se. So, for example, mouthwash. So we, you know, the exploration for the better biomarker goes on, and there's potentially another one that Lisa and I were collaborating with folks. You know, this was the study was collaborating with the USDTL folks. Another study we've been collaborating with some folks at Northwestern, basically looking at the biomarkers PETH or phosphoethyltidinol, which may in fact be a little bit more specific may have some interesting potential for identifying newborns who might have been at risk of exposure for moms who took it during late in their pregnancy.
So,
took alcohol. Later.
So you've identified biomarkers that can help you measure whether or not people have taken alcohol or not. Talk about the study itself in which you use this technique. Who was it that you were doing tests on, and what did you learn in the investigation?
Well, we partnered with United States Drug Testing Laboratories, and it was essentially their grant that was written to the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism that funded the study. And so it's kind of an interesting partnership because we have chemists and researchers at this private laboratory, which they're really the ones doing the developing of how to test for ethylglucuronide, for example, in fingernails, and then asking Michael and myself to partner. And so we're in a school of social welfare, and we have this expertise on how to essentially sample individuals from the community or sample individuals to participate, a large sample. And we looked at individuals who were at a range of different drinking levels, from abstainers to heavy drinking. So we were able to get that sample based on our past experience and expertise. And then it was a random sample as well. And then the second thing that we were able to bring to the table is that we have the experience in interviewing individuals in a very confidential way and setting up procedures so that when we're asking about their self-report in this study, which we needed to do in addition to collecting their hair and fingernails, that we have that expertise to interview individuals in such a way to be able to get very accurate daily drinking information using a calendar method going back 12 weeks. And then the levels of the biomarker ETG, ethylglucuronide, in both hair and fingernails were then compared to individuals' self-report to see how well the biomarkers did in detecting any alcohol use and levels of risk drinking in the past 12 weeks.
Who were the subjects that you were engaged in this study?
Sure. We in order to get that continuum of alcohol use from abstainers to heavy drinkers, we sampled from an undergraduate college students.
A big sample?
Well, 600. The final sample was just over 600.
Correct.
And we had a high percentage who agreed to do the test, the fingernail and hair sample tests, which actually has been an interesting thing because I've been doing this biomarker testing and community samples for a while. In fact, so I wanted to say this. We have a good relationship with USDTL, but originally in the research that I did, I came to them. I said, I'm asking people about illegal drug use, but I want to see if we can validate this. Can you test some biomarkers for us? And we did hair and urine testing and saliva testing out in the community in a couple of studies in Chicago. But one of the issues is that, as I said, people are readily willing to give their sample, samples, but not everybody. And it again, that varies by the specific context. But we had fairly high participation rate in the drug testing here.
You did.
One of the issues that comes up with hair testing, especially if you're an older population and you have a lot of males, a certain percentage are ineligible because they're bald. But I think our younger population, that was less of an issue.
Right, right.
I can identify with that.
Right.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Great to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio, Michael Fendrick, former Wisconsin Distinguished Professor at UWM's Center for Applied and Behavioral Research, otherwise known as CABER, and alongside him, Lisa Berger, who's a scientist and associate professor in that same center. We're talking about the use of biomarkers and ways in which scientists who study human behavior can measure more accurately whether or not people are as forthcoming or as honest as you would want them to be when talking, in this case, about alcohol use. So Lisa, Michael described the way in which you have these 600 college-age students who were part of this test. Here's my question. How did they respond to the very idea of measuring their alcohol use? Had anybody ever asked them before you brought them into this project that they begin recording how much they drink?
Surprisingly well, they responded, and in part because I think we had very sound study procedures. We've been doing this type of research for a long time, and so letting these individuals know that we're not interested in their alcohol use per se. We're interested in everyone's alcohol use, that we're looking at data in the aggregate. So we're not interested in just any individual's alcohol use. That really puts people more at ease that, okay, my data are not just going to be singled out, essentially. And the other way or other ways in which we made people feel very comfortable to give very accurate self-report of their alcohol use is, again, very sound, tight confidentiality procedures. We also had individuals using a calendar-based tool sit down at a computer and enter in their information. There was an interviewer in the room, but that interviewer wasn't standing over the person looking at their data as they entered it into the computer. It was just really more there to answer any questions that participants had. We also use various techniques such as recall aids because we wanted very accurate self-report information. And so we entered in information about local events to help prompt students to remember what their alcohol use was like around those events. We asked students to also put in personal events and holidays that could help them recall their alcohol use, any regular alcohol use patterns that they have. And so it's kind of like putting pieces of a puzzle together to really accurately come up with what their use was going back 12 weeks in this case.
So how accurate were they? You know, did you find cases where there were students who said, well, I didn't drink at all, but in fact the biomarker said, yes, you did?
Yeah,
right. I mean, there are always those cases.
Right. Right. There were a few of those, but part of what the finding is that in terms of the correspondence between the self-report and the drug and the ETG test, this is fairly good correspondence, fairly strong,
right,
and much higher than I had been used to seeing in my studies of drug abuse. So, so all in all, that again, it suggests that these are these biomarkers hold promise. Again, we assumed in this context, even though we had we would have a range of behaviors, but in the young adult population, it might be fairly normative to disclose alcohol use. So in this case, we actually selected this population because we thought a priori that they would be willing to disclose.
As opposed to a 12 or a 13-year-old who might face a very different set of right, of recriminations if in fact they were discovered to be drinking.
Correct.
Correct. Or as opposed to maybe somebody in, you know, even older, where it's, again, older, talking about adults or people in middle-aged adulthood who may not be willing to sort of publicly disclose a lot about their drinking behavior. I mean, that's, you know, different norms in different age groups.
So where do you go from here with these results? What do you think is the next step? You had mentioned earlier, Lisa, perhaps seeing some further advancement or development of the testing, of the test itself, making it perhaps more sophisticated, more sensitive to measuring not just whether alcohol was ingested, but how much. Is that perhaps the next important outcome that could result from this study?
I think that is a direction in which this type of research could head. With our study, we're one of a handful of studies to our knowledge, both here in the United States as well as in European countries, that's actually looked at ethylglucuronide as a long-term alcohol biomarker. And so right now, we're kind of on the cutting edge, and it's just really trying to see what other research groups are going to be able to do in terms of their research. Michael and I are still partnering. There may be other opportunities for us moving forward for grant funding, contract funding, to be able to do some of this research.
And also, you know, thinking about what kinds of potential clinical uses that mm-hmm. these biomarkers have, a little bit thinking about this more expansively. So one idea that I'm working on in Connecticut is looking at using biomarker screening in an outpatient psychiatric clinic where people are selected into the program because premise that they that drinking is not one of their issues. So looking at and again, not just looking at potentially ETG, but we think phosphoethyltidinol. I love saying that. Maybe a more specific biomarker, and so looking at that as well. So those are the kinds of things. Another study that we were looking at was looking at how elevated biomarkers might correlate with other risk behaviors, suggesting that it could potentially be used in a trauma setting, for example, that we found within this sample, elevated rates of ETG in people who reported alcohol-related injury. So there's potentially lots of uses for this, and those are the directions we might take it in further studies.
As we were getting ready for the interview, Michael, you were saying that a lot of Lisa's expertise lies in the area of alcohol research, and you've spent a lot of your career studying drug use. Are biomarkers common and as sophisticated or more sophisticated in terms of measuring drug use versus alcohol use?
I think the way the field of sort of biomarker testing has developed, I think it really arose with the interest in substances, people coming into medical centers with overdoses and trying to figure out in that setting what, in fact, the drugs they were overdosing on were. And, the alcohol field was more focused on these indirect markers until very recently as the technology developed, and technology has been developing very rapidly. And folks like those at USDTL have been part of that technological development, which is exciting. And But yeah, it's widely used, you know, for looking at in forensic situations and criminal justice situations as well as clinical situations. But it's in the research situations as well for drugs of abuse.
I've been watching enough episodes of CSI so that I identify with what you're saying. Lisa, in terms of that, let's get back to that group of the 600 college-age students that you talked to. Did you, in the process of doing this research project, ever reach a point where you wanted to intervene or talk to some of the individuals who you saw as a result of their responses and maybe the biomarker results that they had a problem or a potential problem?
Every participant in the study received resources so that if there was anything that was prompted for them about, oh, maybe I am drinking too much on the weekends, that they had the resources in which they could then contact a counselor to be able to talk about that. The interviewers were well trained to be able to handle those situations as well. So we had various levels and types of resources available to these students so that they could then take next steps. And our interviewers were well trained to be able to facilitate someone to talk to a counselor if they wanted to as well.
And how receptive were the students who may have had some issues? Did they open up? Was it your sense that some students did avail themselves of that additional information or counseling?
Being on a student or campus is that there are really good resources in terms of counselors available. And so that was just a resource in which someone could even walk over to see someone as well.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. But as researchers, mm-hmm. we're somewhat
right.
supposed to be removed from that process.
Mm-hmm. Non-judgmental, right? I mean,
right.
Your
not
goal
judgmental,
is,
but
right.
also not aware of what's going on
right.
with individual subjects. So, you know, we gather the data. It sounds somewhat sterile in a way, but that, again, gives us the wall of confidentiality and protection. You're kind of on this thin line when you're doing this kind of research, too, because you want at some level it to be of some personal benefit if somebody recognizes that they have a problem that they can use resources that you provide them with. But you have to keep your distance and not look at this as at all a clinical situation where we
Correct.
Can intervene.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting as we talk about this in the city of Milwaukee, which is known for beer, and
yes.
the state of Wisconsin, which is known for the consumption of not just beer, but a lot of other alcoholic substances. Is it your sense that that the sort of testing that is being developed through biomarkers might find a special place in terms of medical practices in a state where you have such high and heavy alcohol consumption?
I think so. One thing about the alcohol biomarker research is that it's very much complementary at this point to self-report of alcohol use. So alcohol biomarkers are not meant to supplement essentially getting good information from individuals through, for example, a medical interview or clinical interview using well-trained practitioners. And so in a state like Wisconsin, having really good trained individuals to be able to get that self-report and possibly use a biomarker, alcohol biomarker, as complementary to that process, very much helpful, could very much be helpful.
And I would say, I want to add to Lisa's point that really the best thing you can do is be able to talk to somebody and get good information through questions and direct contact. So this is, I want to endorse what Lisa said. It's
yes.
true about any of these biomarkers. They're supplementing what really the best way to get somebody's history is listen to what they tell us. But
good. It's just another tool. Another tool.
Exactly.
Correct.
Exactly.
Fascinating topic. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your insights with us. Lisa, thank you for the work that you've done at CABR over the years. Lisa is an associate professor in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, working alongside Michael Fendrick. Actually, Michael just wrapping up his career at UWM and moving on to an associate dean position at the University of Connecticut. Thanks for all of your years of service here in Milwaukee, and we wish you the very best in your next chapter.
And thank you so much, Tom. It was a pleasure to be here today.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody. That's all for this week's program. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.